Theater at 7 o'clock, Monday night R&R at 8, live local music on Web Sessions at 10, and recorded local music on Champagne Local 901 at 11. We're going to do some underwriting, and then we are going to jump into In the Know.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and Pizzeria Antica, which strives to provide Champaign-Urbana with an authentic Neapolitan pizza experience, preparing only fresh, all-natural, non-processed ingredients in wood-fired ovens. Taking pizza orders from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Thursday, and 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. Friday and Saturday. Phone 217-530-4137 and online at anticachampaign.com.
Good evening. You're listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1. Welcome to In the Know, a public affairs show where social issues, trending topics, relevant research, and important perspectives are discussed so you, the listener, can be in the know. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the host and guests and not of WEFT. We're streaming live on my personal Facebook page. Listeners are welcome to submit comments and questions on the live stream. But we are going to go ahead and jump in. Tonight we are going to be talking about individualized educational programs. It's something that I think a lot of people kind of have an idea about, but it's definitely a journey that parents have to navigate, and it can be a little complicated. In the studio tonight, I have two special education teachers who are going to help, you know, provide that perspective from the school point of view of, you know, how this process works, the best strategies for parents. I'm going to have them introduce themselves. We're going to start over here with Crystal.
Hello, my name is Crystal Thompson, and I've been teaching for about the past 10 years. Some of my experience includes I was a 7th grade language arts teacher, as well as a 4th grade teacher and a special ed teacher. I'm also a reading specialist, and I'm currently an 8th grade special ed co-teacher at Jefferson Middle School. I'm also the proud mother of a beautiful 12-year-old little girl. I call her still little girl.
She is beautiful, that's for sure. Hi, and my name is Leslie Sullivan, and I am a special educator, reading specialist, and a dyslexia consultant who has been teaching for the past 20-odd years, primarily in special education. I've taught at the elementary level as well as high school, and now I'm currently the reading interventionist for Jefferson, go Jaguars, Middle School here in Champaign.
So, you know, this is one of those, you know, things that I talk to, you know, parents about a lot, that they are kind of overwhelmed by this idea. And I think some parents automatically feel a little intimidated because they feel like they're operating from a deficiency. Like suddenly somebody has told them, even though they haven't said it, you're a bad parent because your child has a struggle and they're not sure how to navigate the system. But to help, you know, the listeners understand, when we're talking about an IEP, what do we mean when we say IEP?
Okay. So an IEP stands for, the acronym is an Individualized Education Plan, and a child who receives services under special education would get what we call an IEP, aka an Individualized Education Plan. And this is mandated under federal law, under the IDEA, which is the Individuals with Disability Education Act. And it spells out, it's a legal document. So when we talk about a child that's receiving special education services and they're receiving an IEP, this is a legal document that's federally mandated under federal law, and the law, of course, being IDEA. An IEP actually spells out three things. It talks about what's going on with a child's learning and or behavioral needs. Then the IEP will talk about the services that the school will provide for your child, providing that they are qualifying for an IEP. And then the main thing is how progress will be measured for your child in this IEP. And of course, the progress, as we call in the world of special education, these are our goals. And the goals that we set for our kids have to be observable and they need to be measurable. For instance, if a child does receive an IEP and has qualified for an IEP, you would not write a goal that would say, Johnny will increase his reading. That's not observable, it's not measurable, but you would write a goal such as Johnny will increase his words read correct by 65 words per minute. So something that you can actually observe and mm-hmm. measure. So in a nutshell, I don't know how in-depth, Sherry, you want us to go with the IEP, but there's really three steps to an IEP. You have to have an evaluation, which is the first step.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where all decisions are made on the data that's collected during the evaluation process. And that's done through testing, through standardized testing, also through interviews, through looking at a child's grades, through observation of your child in the classroom. So all that is looked at.
So when you say standardized testing, are these tests that they are automatically going to take based on whatever grade they're in, or are these tests that then come if the teacher, for instance, says, I think there might be something here that's of concern?
Sure.
Is there additional testing, standardized testing that's offered,
yes.
or is it just based off of what, like, for instance, the entire grade or the entire class would take?
Well, there is that, but that's kind of a different story altogether.
Mm-hmm.
If you're talking about a child that there's a suspicion that there's a disability,
mm-hmm.
and let's say a parent has that suspicion and or a teacher, and they're brought up to like the building, we call it an RTI team, a response to intervention team, and things are done and it's determined that we think we need to do some more testing, depending on what the disability is, what the suspicion of the disability is. And I'm going to use, for instance, let's say we suspect that there's an intellectual disability,
mm-hmm.
then our psychologists would do tests such as a full-scale IQ,
okay.
and they'll do standardized testing based on what we feel that the disability, the suspicion of the disability is.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Once the evaluation is done, that's the first step. And then in the IEP, we also then put down what the present levels of performance is for a child, or we call it the PLOP. And that's, we look at all the evaluation data, the tests are scored, and then it's determined what the child can or cannot do, for instance. And then that's where the goals are written.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, a child is placed, such as it may be a child that needs some resource services. They're still getting educated in the general ed classroom. They have this IEP in place, and they may need a little support through a special educator in the resource room. Or it could be a special educator is pushing into the classroom, which Crystal does as a co-teacher at Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
So she provides services for her kids within the classroom setting.
Mm-hmm.
So in a nutshell, that is what an IEP is.
Okay. No, that's a great explanation.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there's also this misconception of who would qualify for
sure.
an IEP. So it doesn't have to necessarily be one extreme of the spectrum or the other, as far as like behavior or learning.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, could be a subtle, mm-hmm. you know, in between. But what do you commonly see IEPs for? Is it just, you know, learning, or is it also a behavioral component?
It could be both. So
okay.
I think, because I'm sure perhaps there are parents out there listening, a child, in order for a child to have an individual education plan, they have to qualify under one of the 13 categories that
okay.
falls under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act.
Okay.
And there's 13 of those, and I can certainly go into detail. There's specific learning disabilities. There's and under specific learning disabilities, that's primarily your dyslexia, your kids that have dysgraphia, which is a writing disability, dyscalculia, which is a math disability, auditory processing disability, nonverbal learning disability, all falls under the umbrella of specific learning disability.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty broad. But that's only one of the remaining 12 categories that a child would qualify or could qualify. So, and I'll name a few. We call it OHI, other health impairment, and that's something that would limit a child's strength or ability, alertness. For example, ADHD could be an example of a child that would qualify for an IEP under OHI.
Okay.
There's obviously autism and the autism spectrum. Children would also qualify under emotional disturbance, and those are usually our children that we see that have some anxiety disorders,
okay.
depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, those type of disorders. We also have children that qualify under speech and language, visual impairments, Deafness and blindness combined, that's a category all of its own. We then have a category, deafness, just deafness in and of itself, orthopedic impairment, intellectual disabilities, traumatic brain injury, and multiple disabilities. So there's 13 categories that a child would have to fit into one of those in order to qualify for special ed services.
Okay.
Okay.
There's concepts that, yeah, you know, parents hear. So what's the difference between an IEP and a 504?
And I know you all probably think I'm hogging the mic, but Ms. Thompson, Ms. Crystal, and I have already decided
I'm still here.
who is going to answer what questions. And so I kind of, we decided I would kind of front load a bit. So I will talk about the difference between an IEP and a 504. And Sherry, I think it's a great question. I get a lot of parents that ask me about both.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's pretty obvious that in order for a child to get an IEP, they have to fall under one of those 13 categories under IDEA. A 504 is not under the Individual with Disabilities Educational Act. That actually falls under the Vocational Rehabilitation Act. And I want to say, I'm not sure if it's what year it is, but it's a law that falls under that. It does not fall under IDEA. So for a 504, what it does is it provides services and changes to the learning environment that meets the needs of the child. As with IEPs, the 504 plan is provided at no cost to a parent. And actually, it falls under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, where an IEP falls under IDEA. A 504 really is a civil rights law as opposed to an educational law. So that's a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
Another big difference is that a child can have any disability, which can include many learning or attention issues. For example, a lot of children that have ADHD don't necessarily fall under the IDEA law,
mm-hmm,
but they could fall under a 504. And because the 504 has a broader definition of a disability other than the IDEA. So that's a big difference. There's another difference in a 504 versus an IEP. A 504 is mostly about accommodations, where an IEP actually spells out what the educational plan is, what the goals are for the children, what mm-hmm the accommodations are, and so forth. A 504 mainly is what type of accommodations can we put in place to ensure that this child can be successful in the general ed setting. It's much broader. There's not as much accountability to a 504 as there is an IEP.
Okay.
So that's a big difference. Another difference is in an IEP, a parent could actually ask the district to pay for an independent evaluation for their child.
Okay.
The district doesn't necessarily have to do it, but they can ask for it. A 504, a parent cannot ask for an IEE or an independent evaluation. So that's
okay,
a major difference. And another big difference is who comes to an IEP meeting versus who comes to a 504. An IEP meeting, you're going to have usually a fairly large team, and it's going to include a gen ed teacher, a special educator, a psychologist, could be the social worker, speech and language, PT, OT. 504 usually is the parent, the gen ed teacher, perhaps a special ed teacher, and possibly the school principal. So there's some differences there as well. It doesn't have as much accountability, I will say that.
So, you know, when you're talking about, you know, suspecting that something is going on, you mentioned that it could be the teacher, it could be the parent.
Mm-hmm.
Who, I guess, on the school side, though, would take the lead on that if, for instance, the parent or the teacher decides that there might be something going on? Is there a chain that it goes up, or is it the teacher's in charge of it, or how does that work?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, did you say a 504 or an IEP?
IEP, sorry.
An IEP. Your first point of contact would always be a case manager. So a case manager is usually the special education teacher who is, I guess, responsible for ensuring that the student is meeting their goals and is one of the key people that help write the goals along with the team. So they're responsible for monitoring the progress on those goals, making sure the accommodations are in place within their general ed setting and wherever that may be. So if they have other settings such as in PE or in art, those don't just stop in the general or the core classes. They can also go across entire settings. Mm-hmm. So right. the key person is mainly, always start with your case manager. They are going to know the ins and outs. They're going to know what's going on a daily basis and have more contact with your child.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wanting to clarify if that is, and you did a great job at explaining that, Crystal, that's after a child has the IEP. Mm-hmm. Okay. Prior to that, and I don't know if your question was, what are you saying actually prior to having an IEP?
Right.
It would be, so, and if they have an IEP, Crystal answered that question beautifully. If they do not have an IEP and there's suspicion that there's a disability, and you, as we said, a parent could request mm-hmm. an evaluation, and they usually do that in writing, and it's sent usually to the district. But if a teacher, and we have many teachers that suspect things are not quite the way they should be, there's a process for that. There's a form that's filled out. And at least in this district, in Champaign, we have a form that our teachers will fill out. And it's pretty intense, and it asked a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. And that form is then submitted to the building. Some call it a building support team. Others call it a response to intervention team.
Okay.
And it's a team of, I'll use the term, experts that sit on that team to look over what it is that perhaps is going on with this child. And they brainstorm. Because special education really should always be the last resort. You mm-hmm. don't just jump to a special education evaluation. So the team is there to brainstorm. We talk about things that maybe the teacher could do, that type of thing, and give the teacher time or the teacher's time to see if indeed maybe it's not an actual disability, but it's just the kid needs a little extra
encouragement,
support and
yeah.
encouragement. Yeah. And if that's then not the case, then the child is, we relook at that child, we relook at what was put into place, was it successful? If it was, great. If it wasn't, then we might go into talking about looking at getting the child evaluated.
But you would definitely encourage parents to advocate for their student if they suspect something, you know, yeah. if they're observing something at home. I mean, that's actually how you and I met, because my
right.
oldest daughter, I thought there might right. be a dyslexia issue when she was in first grade.
Right.
She was struggling with reading.
Sure.
One of her standardized tests was incredibly low.
Right.
But it was just an encouragement thing.
Right.
She just needed a little bit more, you know, help at home, and then that reinforcement, you know, with the discussion with the teacher. But you know, it really is a big thing to tell parents. If you think anything's off, would you say or agree with it's better to have that concern, express it to the educator, and then have a test done just to be cleared versus, you know, some parents might think, well, we don't want to go to the trouble of having this happen and then, mm-hmm. you know, come to find out.
Sure.
I also think there is a little bit of fear that if you have your child tested and then something does come out, now it's a whole can of worms.
Yeah, it's a whole different ballgame.
Which yeah. can be difficult, you know, as a parent, especially when that's just a whole new world,
sure.
you know, when it comes to special education. And I think there's stigma and, you know, different connotations when it comes to special mm-hmm. ed. But at the end, like you're both saying, it's about support for that student to reach goals and be where mm-hmm. they need
Absolutely.
To be mm-hmm. grade level wise. And so every grade, you know, that's the one thing, you know, I hear teachers talking about is that if the student is not coming out of the previous grade with a strong mm-hmm. grasp on different concepts, it's just mm-hmm. that much harder for the mm-hmm. next grade.
Absolutely,
so,
yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the things, too, that I did want to bring up, we do, I'm going to talk a little bit about Champaign and the district here because, you know, obviously I teach here. I think Champaign's gotten really good about doing, and I'm going to use the term standardized testing, and there's a reason for that. So when our kids, at the beginning of the school year, we are now doing what's called MAP testing.
Mm-hmm.
It is a standardized test, but it's a test where we can then look at those results. Now, keep in mind, I know it's one snapshot mm-hmm. of a kid. It's not the be-all, the end-all. However, it is a good way to look to see if my goodness, is Johnny struggling? And we think he is. And lo and behold, then you look at his benchmark testing and you're like, yeah, he truly is. It just kind of validates what maybe you may or may not know. Mm-hmm. And it's worked in the reverse as well, right?
It's absolutely. Yeah. And we do that 3 times a year. So we start at the beginning of the year in the fall, spring, and then in, well, we fall, winter, spring.
Right.
So we don't just base it off observations. It's also based off of assessments. What is their growth? Was it just a rough test? So it's not just based off of one aspect. We combine various things.
And looking at the benchmark testing is also a good way to see, because we have had parents that were really concerned about their children, and rightfully so. Parents should be concerned and advocate for their children, much as you did, Sherry, which I thought was great. And then lo and behold, like, oh my God, look at your kid. They're like in the 70th percentile. They're doing great. It just might be some motivation. It might just be they do need a little encouragement. But, you know, the suspicion of a disability isn't there. And we can kind of validate that through our testing. So testing does play a role as well.
Well, it's good to, you know, let parents know what you're looking at, you know, what the data is that is being considered, that, like you said, it's not just observation, it's, you know, where are their benchmarks? Because I think sometimes parents may have a misconception that, well, you're just seeing what's going on in the classroom, and how can you really tell from that? And then now you have all these additional tests that need to be done. No, there's an upfront test that's done that helps to, you know, give that indication, which was part of, you know, with my daughter.
Right.
Luckily, you know, there wasn't a learning disability there, but again, that benchmark was not met. And so it is good to be able to say, hey, can we just check this out?
Absolutely.
See if something's going on. I think that would be, you know, as a parent, you know, where I would tell other parents to just talk to your kid's teacher, find out if they have, are they seeing the same things you are?
Right.
There could be a disconnect between classroom and home.
Absolutely.
I think that's the other thing parents don't always consider is how the child operates in the classroom with the great teacher and could have that extra support. Maybe they're doing fine, but at home, maybe there's a struggle because, you know, different environmental things going on.
Right.
So,
exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, you were talking about the goals of the IEP meeting. And so when we talk about, we're sitting down, we're having this, you know, team of people evaluate and talk about what we want to set, what are kind of, what's the overall outcome we're looking at from each IEP meeting? And how often do IEP meetings happen?
You want to take that?
We have, every year we have an IEP meeting. So we go over progress and we set goals. So the purpose of an IEP meeting, it's basically a meeting where your child's special education team, so the members that Leslie had mentioned earlier, all come together, including you. You're part of the team. So it's not an absolute. You're a person with a say. And
if you're mean the parent.
Absolutely. I'm sorry, I'm speaking to you.
Sherry, the parent.
As the parent, you're part of the team. So everybody comes together and you develop some goals. And those goals are based off of that child's deficits. So whatever your child's deficit area is, then we set measurable goals, as Leslie mentioned earlier, and then how we're going to measure those goals. And accommodations, all of those things that basically that will help a child be successful. So whether that be successful in a gen ed setting, whether it be in a self-contained setting, so it's very, it's different for each child, but to help them be successful and to make gains, and what can we do to help them make those gains?
Right. And I think it's really important for parents to understand that their role is vital in the implementation of an IEP. And I really always encourage, as a former case manager, I'm no longer doing special education, but as a former case manager, I felt it my duty and moral obligation to let my parents know, you are a vital part of this meeting. And really, an IEP should never be written without parental input. It's a team decision, and it really is a document that should be written by the team, and the parents are a vital part of that. And I think it can be a little overwhelming for parents, and we can talk about that a little bit later, but the role of a parent is, I can't emphasize that enough. It's very important.
Well, and I think, you know, one of the terms that you used, you know, when you're talking about the people who are in attendance at the IEP meetings is expert, but parents are also experts on their children. Oh, yeah. And so, again, is there, you know, is it congruent between household and classroom, or is there a disconnect there? And like you said, whatever is being done at the school, there has to be support for it, obviously, at home. And so while you can definitely appreciate that it can be an overwhelming experience for the parent, they do have to engage, and they do have to be aware of, you know, like you said, each of those steps. What is this IEP plan? You know, what is the plan really going to do for my student? And I think it's probably, you know, goes without saying, if a parent has a million questions, it's better to ask those questions, especially in the very beginning, versus having a ton of questions, not asking them, and then kind of feeling like you're stumbling as a parent, not doing what you would prefer to do to help support your student.
And I want to say, too, and I'm going to give kudos to my partner over here, Ms. Thompson. She now is working as a co-teacher, and she ends up spending, I mean, you're constantly on the phone with your parents.
Oh, yeah.
Like, sometimes I laugh and make fun of her in a good way, good-natured way. But I'm like, my goodness, I think you're spending more time with your kids' parents than you do, like, with your own daughter. It's a joke. But it really is important to do that.
Everybody has different modes of communication, and a lot of mine, because I travel from classroom to classroom, I'm not able to check my email, so a lot of them will then text. So it's convenient for the parents if they're at work or anything. For me, whenever I get a chance to glance at it, you know, Bobby left his homework here on the table. Is it okay if he turns it in tomorrow? Or does he have homework and, you know, trying to make plans for the day, or what things do I need to prep for them to go home? So
And I think Crystal would agree with this, and Sherry, I know that you were this type of parent, super involved. I've not met a special educator or a case manager, I really haven't, that has not wanted parental involvement. Because we know how powerful it is when we have a good relationship with the parent. It makes our job easier, and truly, in a nutshell, it's better for the child. So we encourage parents to ask questions. We want that. So the more we can do that and work as a team, the more powerful it is for the kids too.
It adds another advocate.
Yeah, it really does.
You know,
right?
Yeah.
So, you know, just so parents understand, you know, kind of the, you know, how these teams are comprised. And, of course, they want to make sure that the right people are, you know, evaluating their students. Who is then kind of tasked with doing that evaluation, continual evaluation of the student? And, you know, what type of official training does that person have that makes them qualified to do that evaluation?
So we had, Crystal and I were kind of talking a little bit earlier today, you know, looking over some things. And, you know, I think when we talk evaluation, I think it's very prudent to understand what an evaluation entails. I mean, really, when you think about it, it's many things. It's testing, for sure, because you are looking for specific type of a disability. Again, it's interviews with parents, it's interviews with teachers, it's looking at grades, it's observations. And that's done by a team. So I'm going to use an example. If a parent suspects perhaps that their child might have a reading disability, for instance, and they bring that concern up, our psychologists are the ones that primarily do our testing, and they will do a variety of standardized testing to look for whatever the suspicion of the disability is. If it's a suspicion of a child having a speech and or language impairment, then of course we would have a speech and language therapists do testing. We also have our social workers that do interviews with the parents, and they look at a lot of different things if there's suspicion of some behavioral issues. So it's really a team comprised of a team of, again, I'm using the term experts, but people in that field that understand what the testing is comprised of. And so they're the people, primarily psychologists, social workers, speech and language. We look at our general ed teachers, any testing that they've done. The special educator at that point really is not involved with the testing, because at that point, the child is not in special education. So they're not really part of the testing. That comes after the child is deemed eligible for special education, and then a special educator may do a lot of testing to see, you know, what they and how they want to teach that kid.
Mm-hmm.
So those usually are primarily. If you're talking about children getting like full-scale IQs, that's always done through our school psychologist, and they have a lot of training in obviously doing assessments and testing, diagnostic testing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you have a situation where, for instance, IEP now is in place, mm-hmm. And you have a student who just continues to struggle, you know, there's not enough, you don't feel satisfied with the progress that's being made. Where do you go from there? I mean, because I think that is a concern mm-hmm. parents have once they start this journey is mm-hmm. what if we have an IEP and things aren't getting better?
So that's mostly up to, I would say, the gen ed, depends their setting. If they're within a gen ed setting, for instance, I'm a co-teacher. So if that student, I'm an eighth grade co-teacher. If that student is in a co-teaching setting, it would be up to the gen ed teacher and myself to review the progress. We review it every few weeks. Maybe we progress monitor every week where we mm-hmm. look at the student's growth, meeting their goals. And if they're not making adequate growth, after usually we wait about 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Then, 6 to 8, right?
Yeah,
usually.
6 to 8 weeks. Then we go ahead and we make some changes. That doesn't necessarily have to be in the IEP. That just means we need to make changes in order to make that growth. So it could be we need to make a smaller group. Maybe if the student has to, they need some peer support. Just other things we can add in the classroom. It doesn't necessarily have to be in an IEP.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can add those supports just like we would do for a gen ed student. So those things can be put into place, and we just have to make different, we have to add things, or it's kind of a, especially getting to know a student, we don't exactly know when we get them every year. We just have to, we speak to the case managers and look at their IEP, but not everything is necessarily in the IEP. And a student changes from year to year. So what works 1 year, oh my goodness, we find it definitely may not work the next year. So what,
especially in junior high, because our kids are, you know, they're junior high and mm-hmm. hormones and you name it. So, but I think Crystal brought up a good point. We do, for our kids that have IEPs, we do progress monitoring weekly mm-hmm. based on what their deficit areas are. So commonly, a lot of our kids will qualify under the umbrella of specific learning disability.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be reading, could be math, it could be writing, it could be a combination of all three. And so let's hypothetically say it's a child that has deficits in math. Then we're going to progress monitor weekly using standardized testing to look at growth in math. We have two that we use in our district. It's called the MCOMP and the MCAP. So we look at that, we progress monitor them weekly, we look at that data, we see, is this child making growth? If they're not, as Crystal said, then we kind of massage things and we say, well, maybe he needs a smaller group, maybe he needs some more intense instruction, maybe he needs more instruction,
mm-hmm.
so, you know, more frequency of instruction. So it's not a perfect science.
No. It's, I mean, I had to, yeah. I had a student that was struggling in writing, and we actually gave him a Chromebook versus the physical writing aspect. He was able to formulate ideas and work wonderfully just by typing, which mm-hmm. is
as
doable.
Opposed to the writing. Yeah,
exactly. So yeah. That wasn't in his IEP, but that was okay. We ended up adding it to his IEP mm-hmm. later that he had access to that. And it, I mean, but that was not originally part of it. And that was something that we had to just try and figure out what was holding him back. Was it the physical aspect of the actual writing itself? But what we're looking at and what we're assessing is not the physical writing. We're looking at the ideas and what he's trying to put on paper. And
right.
can he do the work
right.
if we put it in a different yeah. modality?
Sure. So
see, it's good to know that there's flexibility there. Because
yeah.
I think, again, you know, just playing devil's advocate from a parent perspective, they may feel like, okay, this IEP is you know, written in stone. Mm-hmm. This is exactly what my child has access to. These are the resources that we'll have. But it's good to know that from the educator point of view, you're just looking for the way to make it work. Mm-hmm. And that can come in a lot of different forms. And it's great to know that resources can be, you know, removed if they're not working. Mm-hmm. Or you can add something that you think, hey, this worked for another student, or this has been something that we know has worked mm-hmm. in the past. We can add it and see how it works, like you said, with the Chromebook. Mm-hmm. I think that's really something parents should have some comfort with, knowing Absolutely. That yeah. if the progress isn't there, we just don't throw everything away and say, okay, well, it didn't work with this IEP that we have right now, so it's just not going to work. Right. No, we'll adapt. We'll right. figure it out.
Absolutely.
We're advocating for your child, too.
And that's just good teaching, whether your child has an IEP or not. General education teachers do that a lot, as do special educators. That's part of being a teacher and looking and analyzing and seeing what works, what doesn't, and how do you tweak it, how do you not. Of course, for a general ed student versus a student with an IEP, there's much more accountability with the mm-hmm. child with an IEP, of course, and you're not going to change goals without having an IEP meeting. But as far as, like Crystal said, you would try a Chromebook with a kid in the general ed
We look for creative ways to meet those goals. We want them to make progress, and we just try and find ways to do that. And it's just really being creative.
Yeah, trying as best we can.
yeah. So, you know, one of the things, you know, we have kind of this underlying thing, a theme of, you know, parent engagement. So how important is that relationship between especially the general ed teacher and the parents? Because I could see that being obviously very detrimental as far as the progress that student makes, which is why I always encourage parents, talk to your teacher first, mm-hmm. find out what's going on. Try to be open, you know, listen first. But it can still be a struggle. I know sure. parents can feel like, well, you're targeting my child, or they're not struggling as much as you think. So, you know, what would be your recommendations to parents, you know, either before when they have a suspicion or once an IEP is in place, as far as how important that relationship is?
I think it's really what I found is it's basically up to the parent. Each parent is different. Some parents only want you to call them if there's a problem. Mm. And they are kind of, they don't want to deal with a lot of it and struggle with the idea of special ed and sometimes IEPs. And they just want to be in problem-solving mode. Other parents, I call probably almost daily or text almost daily. But realistically, most of them probably weekly. So getting them involved is a huge asset to the kid, because you can help solve problems not only at school, but also bring it around in mm-hmm. their home setting as well. Mm-hmm. So working on an assignment, I will have parents that are struggling or their child is struggling with trying to complete an assignment. And they text, and I said, you know, check his phone. I had him take a picture of examples, whereas they take horrible notes sometimes. And even if I provide them, sometimes they mm-hmm. lose them. So the parents then can help their student, their child, complete an assignment or do something that we've been struggling with. But also, you know, just having that close communication
right.
is a great yeah. support.
And I think, you know, with anything, I think parents, as do teachers, want to feel valued. Mm-hmm. And they want to feel that they're part of the solution rather than the problem. And so I think if teachers, and the majority of teachers, you know, I'm, you know, shout out to all the teachers out there. You know, we work hard and we really do want to foster relationships with our parents, for the most part, absolutely. And as Crystal was saying, you know, there's, you almost have to be a fortune teller, because we do have parents that really are like, don't want to be bothered, you know, mm. unless it's really something we need to know, because they're overwhelmed. Mm. And we get that. They're, you know, working. Some of our parents are working 2 and 3 jobs. They're trying to make ends meet. And, you know, but and I, then there's, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I find that to be true for not only special ed teachers, right. but teachers in general.
Right. Absolutely.
We kind of will call and we will look. We'll basically see what the response is. If you're wanting more communication, we are all about
it. We're all over it. Right. Because we want that. And I think most teachers do.
Absolutely.
You know, but I think it's one of those things where you have to be approachable as a teacher. you have to let your parents know, I'm here for you. That's our job, and we want to be there for our parents. And so I think I can only speak for myself. I have very different relationships with all my parents. It just depends on what they want and what they want me to provide, if that makes sense.
No, it does, and I can definitely see that, you know, component of they're overwhelmed and that might cause them to disengage. But, you know, really the big thing, like, you know, I said a little bit ago, if you don't try to correct whatever's going on, it just gets harder and gets harder.
Absolutely.
And then you have a student who disengages because they're frustrated.
Right.
And, you know, middle school, elementary school, those are kind of your, you know, testing the waters. But high school is really where you have to hit the ground running. And and then you're wanting, you know, your child to either have a, you know, gainful employment or go to college. And I think sometimes it's hard to have that appreciation that a problem that starts in first grade can easily become an unchecked problem, or it's one that's not satisfactorily dealt with from the household when somebody's a sophomore in high school. And then you really start to see what is the potential here and where did we miss the boat on that. And so, you know, I always encourage parents, like I said, talk to your teachers.
Absolutely.
Because the worst thing you want to do is not address it, and then what started out small now has really avalanched into a huge problem. So if a parent, for instance, maybe they are overwhelmed, the first meeting comes and goes and they're like, I have no idea what's going on. Could they request another meeting, or could they, I mean, not necessarily with the whole team, or could they request it with the whole team, or is it then just with the teacher, or how does that work if the parent says, okay, I went, I took notes, but I'm still feeling like I'm behind the eight ball. I want to know more about how I can be a better advocate for my student and more involved.
And that's for, Sherry, you're saying for a child that already does have an IEP.
Right.
So the parent's gone to the meeting. They're feeling very overwhelmed.
And you can always request a team meeting. So
okay.
It doesn't necessarily have to be an IEP meeting, but it can be a team meeting. And a lot of times those questions could be answered by the case manager, which is the special ed teacher who is working with your child. So they can answer usually the majority of those. And a lot of times your questions aren't the questions that are asked are usually general questions that, you know, they have knowledge of, not necessarily specific. And if they are specific, we can then lead it to whether it be the speech teacher or whoever that person may be. But I think a lot of the problems can be solved just by the person on
reaching
front
out
lines, which is the case manager.
Yeah. And we use that term, and I don't know that we really defined what a case manager is. But in the world of special education, every child is assigned a special educator that is the point of contact for the parent and for that child. And they actually do manage that child's IEP, and they're there to advocate for the child. They work very closely, or should, with the general ed teacher and or any related services providers. So, for instance, let's say you have a child and the child has a disability in writing, but they also have a language disability as maybe even a secondary disability, or it's a related service. That case manager kind of coordinates all that with the speech and language therapist, with the gen ed teacher, and kind of keeps the IEP at the forefront of everybody's mind. They make sure accommodations are met. They make sure that goals are being worked on. They make sure that all the progress is being done. And they're the ones that usually is the first line of defense, really. If a parent needs questions answered for a child with an IEP, they really should go to the case manager. And our case managers know what they can and cannot do. And if it's above their head, they're going to then say, you know what, we're going to get you in touch with our SPED administrator at the district level and or, you know, the psychologist or whomever.
Okay.
And that's the way it should work.
But even as a case manager, I mean, sometimes I have some of my kids 4 hours a day. So I have them reading, writing, math, and then I teach an extra either reading or math, an intense instruction of that. So if I have them 4 hours a day, I have a pretty good idea of what's going on with them, and whether it be emotional, whether it be academic, whatever that may be. So case managers are pretty on top of it, usually involved, usually in the academic that child's academics. So
from, you know, an educator point of view, obviously this is really tough work. You know, being a special education teacher, like you said, there's a lot of things that you're juggling at the same time to make sure the student has everything that they need. Right. Where are your biggest obstacles as educators? You know, what is it, just the resources aren't available within the district, or, you know, obviously parent disengagement is a big problem. But, you know, from your day to day, where can you have better support or better resources?
Can I say one word? I believe it's time.
I was going to say, I think we need about 27 hours a day.
I really think it boils down to time. I think my frustration as a case manager was not having enough time to collaborate with the gen ed teacher or with the speech and language therapist. Excuse me, or the social worker, because we are a team and we really need to be in sync, and we want to be, but a lot of times, and Crystal and I have laughed about this, we're sitting here trying to talk with our social worker about, you know, a behavioral issue, and, you know, our social worker's like, walk with me, walk, you know, because they're heading down to, you know, another child in distress, or the gen ed teacher's plan time is at a different plan time than us. So if I had to say one thing, it would be time. Having more time to do that collaboration that's so essential.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How about you, Crystal? What do you think?
I wholeheartedly agree with that. Trying to meet, like I said, I teach reading, writing, math, whether it be reading intervention, math intervention, and then trying to collaborate with all those families, with the teachers, trying to stay on top of my students, and then something happens
and progress
PE,
monitoring.
Art, and then,
so I mean, there's
trying
a lot.
To catch up on my special education paperwork. That's on my own time because I'm teaching during the day. You know, any of that stuff and parent calls again.
On our own time.
Yes.
You know, that because we're, you know, we are in a profession where we're not behind a desk where we can do our job and make phone calls and do our paperwork. That's all done, you know, before school, after school. And of course, yes, we get a 40-minute plan period. And that's usually time that teachers are like, hey, I haven't gone to the bathroom all day, or I need to go get something to drink. But you get our
Leslie
point.
Leslie used to make fun of me and say I look like I was art on a cart. I'd be rolling around in my cart, pushing my materials,
all
rushing from
the
room
building.
To room. Yeah. Yes, because I have a 2-minute passing period to get from one side of the building to the other. So, exactly. I would agree with that.
So, you know, one of the things that a couple of the, you know, council members for the PTA council, that is, have talked about over the years is, you know, maybe having parent peer mentor groups where you have parents who have had children with IEPs, have gone through the experience. You know, just because a parent disengages does not negate the need of that student, like you've said. You know, everything still has to be coordinated. You still have to keep pushing forward. And, you know, in the interim, when the parent's hopefully going to bridge that gap and have a better relationship with the teacher, whoever is part of the team, you know, if there's another parent who can understand the IEP struggle because they've gone through it, can, you know, offer strategies and tips and, you know, that encouragement, because sometimes parents also need encouragement. You know, there's a lot of parents who are an asset, I think, in the school and could be pivotal in saying, okay, here's why it's important for you to talk to the teacher. Here's why it's important for you to listen to the school psychologist or social worker, because they've experienced it. They know what's...
They've been through it themselves.
Yeah, they know what's really important. Yeah. And so that's one of the things we would like to see, because there are plenty of parents in the district who have had those experiences who could share that with, you know, another parent. And then just hopefully be a support when the parent is overwhelmed. They have that other parent. They can say, am I doing this right? I feel like I'm not doing anything right.
Well, who doesn't want that? I mean, to me, if I were navigating uncharted waters, I would want to go to somebody that's been there and say, hey, help me out. I don't know how to do this. I know you've actually been there. In other words, to me, they have the credibility, as opposed to, you know, talking to maybe just their friends or other people that haven't gone through the same thing that they're going through.
Right.
I think it's a wonderful idea. Is it something that you're thinking of getting up and running?
I mean, I'm hoping that we can just talk to teachers, talk to, you know, parents who've had the experience, find out how we can get this going, and then maybe pilot it next year at one of the schools to see how, you know, how it works. Because, again, I feel like there are parents who are just really quick to disengage. It's just really overwhelming from the get. And like you said, they only want to know when things are really bad. It's like, well, you
and
should know about everything.
You know, I mean, we do have parents. And this is not we're not bashing our parents at all, because we have extremely very engaged parents in this district for the most part. But I also understand if you're a parent and your child has struggled their whole life, after a while, you don't want to hear it. It's it's just, it's daunting. And I think that that's why it's so important for teachers, case managers, whatnot, to find the good, something positive a child's doing, and also make those phone calls too, right? Instead of always calling on the negativity. But you're right, it's very daunting. So to have somebody, a parent can go to, a peer that's been through it, I think would be phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, again, hopefully you can be that difference in how a parent engages, or if they engage at all, just because that, like you said, that parent can say, if I didn't, if I hadn't engaged, here's probably where my student would have been. But now I have a relationship with whoever it
the
is on that
manager,
team.
The case manager, the gym teacher, whomever, somebody in the building that you can go to. Yeah, I think is important.
Well, I would say most of my parents that are not as involved, it's not because of necessarily they've disengaged, it's because they're working multiple jobs. So if they're a single parent, you know, which we have quite a few parents there, single parents, myself, working multiple jobs, it's available. The availability, I mean, trying to make these meetings when you have multiple kids. All of my days, I don't have the luxury of being sick, because they go to my daughter all of my sick days. The same thing could be said with parents, trying to get them to the meeting. So maybe along what you're saying, support systems, but maybe also using technology. So why not, you know, a website or things where exactly what you're saying they can go to. I would love to see that. If there was one change I could make, it would be some type of support website for the district, or a go-to site that would explain, you know, all of these things, the basic vocabulary, explaining the assessments, explaining what is an IEP, all of
maybe
these
in more user-friendly terms. And maybe there is something out there like that. I'm not aware of it, but there could be. And if not, I'm sure, Sherry, you would get that ball rolling, because she gets the ball rolling all the time.
Well, you know, even having, I mean, you see it with companies. They have message boards for frequently asked questions, and people are able to kind of have, well, this is how you do it, versus having to call, like, for instance, a customer service line and wait forever. Here's the answer already. And I think there is a lot of power, you know, hopefully with giving parents that, you know, chance to have a voice and not only advocate for their student, but then being able to advocate for other parents. I think there's a lot of empowerment with that. You know, we also, I've also looked at being, you know, social worker myself, just kind of making them makeshift social workers. So if you already have a conversation going on with this parent, do they have other needs in the household that maybe you could connect them to? Again, they may not be comfortable going to the teacher, the social worker, the principal, because of whatever stigma they're worried about, but maybe they would listen to another parent. And so why would it hurt to have parents who know about other local resources?
And, you know, even if there were teachers that could help support that process, that, you know, could lend their, I use the term expertise, I'm using that broadly, but could lend their knowledge base to, you know, the process, and kind of help guide things along too, you know, to help with that, to support those peer groups, I think would be a great thing as well.
Yeah, so, I mean, it definitely sounds like that the teachers, you know, you guys have a ton to do. And so being able to find ways to support you as well as the parent is very critical, because obviously as time, you know, is in, you know, short demand, you know, if you don't have a lot of that, then again, where can parents come in and fill in these gaps to help you guys do your job better? And if maybe it's just reminding a parent, hey, this is what you need to stay on top of as a parent. This is what you need to listen to when they're talking to you. You know, whatever
these are the questions that maybe you want to ask your case manager. Or, you know, I found when my child was struggling, and I talked with the case manager and asked about this accommodation, that was helpful. So, yeah, there's just a multitude of things that could come out of those type of dialogue with parent to parent.
Absolutely. Well, you know, even if, you know, we can get a website off the ground, I think parent input on what should be on that website is also critical.
Absolutely.
Especially when administrators have one point of view of what they want to push out versus, okay, well, the parents might be saying, well, we get that, but here's what we really need.
Here's what we need.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's definitely a process, and it's good to know, like, from the administrator, from, well, the educator point mm-hmm. of view, like, what you guys consider and what you, you know, where you start, where you, what the process is, because mm-hmm. I think a lot of parents, that might be why they don't come to their teacher when mm-hmm. they notice something is going on, because they aren't sure of what that process is. And it's really scary yeah. to think, what if my child needs to be in right. special education? Exactly. What does that mean now?
Right.
And
now, what
are they
mean?
Forever special education? Yeah. I think that's the other part.
I think it would be very scary. Mm-hmm. I'm a mother of two sons, and I have not had to navigate that personally, just in my professional life. And professionally, you know, I have said at many meetings and just felt such a tug at my heart watching the faces of parents, because you know it's devastating to hear that your child is struggling and yeah. or has a disability. So, you know, anything we can do as teachers, we try.
Absolutely. We struggle with our
we
own.
We struggle too, but
daughter,
we try.
We've had many, many conversations. Yeah. My daughter struggles socially, so this has been an ongoing thing we've been talking about ourselves.
Yeah. Well, this will definitely be the first of many conversations about, you know, IEPs, because I think, as you know, parents provide feedback, and you know, if we do something like a website, mm-hmm. how parents can get engaged and how mm-hmm. they can stay engaged with these topics. I know PTAs are always wanting to find new ways to support their schools. Right. Here's one of those ways that PTAs can get behind this.
I love that idea, Sherry. Yeah. I really do. I think anytime people that are going through whatever it is they're going through together, it's just more powerful. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to me, I think it's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, and it never hurts to build coalition. I think, right. you know, there's a lot to be said of, you know, having a strong unification to give mm-hmm. that feedback to administration at the mm-hmm. district level, that here's what we're seeing. This isn't just us complaining. This is us giving constructive feedback on what's better for us.
Exactly.
That helps us. And mm-hmm. at the end of the day, that really is what the mm-hmm. district should want to hear mm-hmm. is how do we make those tweaks and whatever mm-hmm. so we have our parents engaged and we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, which right. is educating our students in a better way.
And Sherry, I just want to say I really liked what you said about, you know, I think everybody has positive intentions. Mm-hmm. I go through life really truly believing that. And I think our administrators as well as our teachers do have those positive intentions. But we have our own vantage point. So I liked when you said, but that may not necessarily be the questions that a parent wants answered. So getting what those questions are from the parents, mm-hmm. I think would be really powerful as well.
Yeah, definitely. So it's constructive and everybody's mm-hmm. moving in the right mm-hmm. direction. Well, thank you guys for being on the show.
Absolutely.
Like I said, this is
a joy.
The
Anytime.
First of many conversations I'm sure we'll have on this, you yeah. know, as parents provide feedback from even the
Absolutely.
Show tonight.
Absolutely. And we would, when Crystal and I will speak for Crystal, anytime anybody wants to talk about reading, we're your girls.
Awesome. Great.
All right.
Well,
great.
Thank you to the listeners for tuning into In the Know on WEFT Champaign. Tonight's show will be archived on Radio Free America, weft.org, and also on my personal Facebook page. You're welcome to provide any type of feedback from the show. If there's questions, again, like we said, if there's questions you have, we definitely want to make sure that we are answering those appropriately. Thank you again, ladies, for being here. I'm sure, like I said, we will definitely have more to talk about. Thanks.
Never forget where you come from. Yeah.